It's time. So, welcome. Let's get started. Friday afternoon, and our session is unpronounceable to most people. I'll get to that in a minute. I want to just intro briefly what the series is about and placing this particular session in it. The trajectory that I'm on is investigating with a critical lens the pioneer stories, Little House on the Prairie, and asking a question about the significance of those stories as a story about white America, especially the pioneer settlers coming out and settling on native lands. And I'm asking that set of questions about the story of Laura Ingalls Wilder and the series Little House on the Prairie. And I'm also asking stories about my own family story, and it's the case that they intertwine. My great-grandma was double cousins with Laura. They were born in Pepin the same year and grew up together. And so investigating this iconic American story is also a way for me to think through my own story. And the reason those two stories are important for me to engage right now as a Lutheran pastor and theologian and person who likes to research and write, I hope I'll write a book about this, is because there's a story of what's happening with our nation right now, moving from a historically white majority population to white minority. The elementary school level in the United States probably is already a majority people of color, and the whole nation will be in another decade or two. And a number of sources, both books I've read and friends I have raised the challenge to me that people of color often have to tell what they describe as confessional stories or stories about their own racial ethnic identity. And white people don't very often have to tell a white story. And my suggestion my suggestion to you as we go through this session is that all of us, if we're white, we have particular stories. And our transition in these next years in our country, I think, will be a more just and generous transition to being one at the table rather than determining the table in our country if we do more critical, more honest storytelling about our own lives and our own family background. So that's what I'm trying to do for myself as a way to encourage what I think is important work for white people in our country right now. I was talking with someone while I was on Dish Team at lunch. I don't see her right now. Oh, no, it was someone else who told me about Hillbilly Elegy, which is another version of what I'm up to, telling a kind of white story, but telling it in its complexity and particularity, and not just assuming that whites are the dominant story, so we don't have to tell the particularity of our story. It's universal. Well, today is a story about Romanus Pontifex, is just the Roman pontiff. It's about the Pope. That's the first couple of words of this papal bull that we're going to look at. I want to do what in a television show you'll often see as a flashback. There'll be the story going along, and all of a sudden there'll be a flashback to, say, childhood, you know, and they'll fill in some details and then come back to the storyline, and you're like, oh, okay, I see what's happening here, because you went back and got some details that help make sense of what's unfolding in the narrative. Well, there's this very strong opinion or common sense view that you hear in the Little House on the Prairie books about white people's right to the land, that it's just, that it's just matter of fact that the white people should come and have the land and the Indians should leave the land. And there's a reason for that. There's a reason for that in both the history of Christianity in the West and the legal history of the West, and they intertwine. And I want to do that pause today and go back and look at the evolution of that idea, where that comes from. And I want to do that to start with by, and this is, by the way, a beautiful picture of Pope Nicholas V, who wrote the 1455 papal bull, the one we're going to talk about in a few minutes. And it's just just pause and look at this. The jewels on the, I don't even know what that hat's called. Anyone know? Is it a mitre? Is that like a very fancy, old-fashioned mitre?
It's a mitre.
Yeah. The mitres that they wear today don't quite have the jewels. I wonder if the Vatican still has this one though in their vault. I have it on the actual picture, but I didn't put it up here. I don't remember. Peter something.
I do believe they still have it. I've seen it even used up into the early 20th century.
Yeah, wouldn't it be at all surprised if it's there? Well, I'd like to start by a reading of two sections from Little House on the Prairie, which is the second book in the series. It's the book where they leave the little house in the Big Woods in Wisconsin, and they go to Kansas. And we're going to hear just a brief section from the very start of the novel and then jump ahead to a section in the middle, and the two pieces are interconnected. The second piece has a description of Pa playing his fiddle and Ma singing, a song that was very famous and was, in fact, the most popular song of the 19th century in America. And I got a popular recording of it from 1937 from this gang and put the lyrics up here. So when we get to that part, I'll play instead of just reading the novel, we'll stop reading and play the song. And you can imagine Pa playing his violin and Ma singing. And then we'll pick up with the story. Sonia's going to read. Start at the beginning and read to here.
A long time ago, when all the grandfathers and grandmothers of today were little boys and little girls, or very small babies, or perhaps not even born, Pa and Ma and Mary and Laura and baby Carrie left their little house in the Big Woods of Wisconsin. They drove away and left it lonely and empty in the clearing among the big trees, and they never saw that little house again. They were going to the Indian country. Pa said there were too many people in the Big Woods now. Quite often, Laura heard the ringing thud of an axe, which was not Pa's axe, or the echo of a shot that did not come from his gun. The path that went by the little house had become a road. Almost every day, Laura and Mary stopped their playing and stared in surprise at a wagon slowly creaking by on that road. Wild animals would not stay in a country where there were so many people. Pa did not like to stay either. He liked a country where the wild animals lived without being afraid. He liked to see the little fawns and their mothers looking at him from the shadowy woods, and the fat, lazy bears eating berries in the wild berry patches. In the long winter evenings, he talked to Ma about Western country. In the West, the land was level, and there were no trees. The grass grew thick and high. There were wild animals wandered and fed as though they were in a pasture that stretched much farther than a man could see. And there were no settlers, only Indians lived there. That evening, when Mary and Laura were in bed, Pa played his fiddle. Ma was rocking in the rocking chair, holding baby Carrie against her breast, and she began to sing softly with the fiddle.
Swift as an antelope through the forest.
Ma's voice and the fiddle's music softly died away, and Laura asked, "Where did the voice of Alpharetta go, Ma?" "Goodness," Ma said, "aren't you asleep yet?" "I'm going to sleep," Laura said, "but please tell me where the voice of Alpharetta went." "Oh, I suppose she went west," Ma answered. "That's what the Indians do." "Why do they do that, Ma?" Laura asked. "Why do they go west?" "They have to," Ma said. "Why do they have to?" "The government makes them, Laura," said Pa. "Now go to sleep." He played the fiddle softly for a while. Then Laura asked, "Please, Pa, can I ask just one more question?" "May I?" said Ma. Laura began again. "Please, Pa, may I?" "What is it?" Pa asked. It was not polite for little girls to interrupt, but of course Pa could do it. "Will the government make these Indians go west?" "Yes," said Pa. "When white settlers come into a country, the Indians have to move on. The government is going to move these Indians farther west any time now. That's why we're here, Laura. White people are going to settle all this country, and we get the best land because we get here first and take our pick. Now do you understand?" "Yes, Pa," Laura said. "But, Pa, I thought this was Indian territory. Won't it make the Indians mad to have to..." "No more questions, Laura," Pa said firmly. "Go to sleep."
So I won't move on from that until I just let you notice things and respond, either about the song itself, the fact that Ma was singing it, who throughout the books has very, very strong negative ideas about Indians, or comments about the section we read. Anything strike you? Yeah.
Uh-huh. And she asked these sort of sympathetic human level questions. I mean, there clearly has a decision to ask in sort of compassion and curiousness about these things. And clearly the parental, the words of wisdom from the parents are, you know, this is how it is.
Yeah.
But there's a little bit of a sensitivity, like, isn't this, I guess I'm wondering what you make of that.
Yeah. Yeah, especially at the end when she says, "Won't it make them mad to have to leave?" And she's
it's
told.
Like it's opened up.
Yeah.
And then it's shut down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Nelson.
The song itself is a lamentation.
Yeah,
whoever
it is.
Whoever wrote it was on the Indian side, obviously.
It was. It in fact was the first successful popular song written by a woman in the U.S. It was 1830s, 1840s, but she was out east. I don't know her story. I don't know the story of the song, but it is a kind of, she's lamenting, she's an Indian woman lamenting for her Indian warrior love, and it's a song of loss. That's right. Other things you noticed that struck you?
The government is clearly blamed.
Yeah. They're the ones who were going to come and make the Indians go. Yeah. Well, in the knot, well, you may or may not be here, but the next session, early next week, is going to dig more into this story and the relationship of the novels to the native peoples themselves. And in this novel, they went to this land because Pa had heard from a man in Washington that they were soon going to change the treaty rights for this Osage Diminished Reserve in Kansas and move them off of the land and allow settlers to get the land. So he'd heard, that's where that comes from when he says the government's going to come and move these Indians and we're going to have first choice of the land. Yeah.
I'm struck by that same thing about the government. But maybe the government's role is like conscious pilot, where you know it's the upswell of the religious leaders, the Jewish religious leaders that are bringing Jesus to trial, and so Pontius Pilate gets the blame for making the decisions and making everything move forward.
Yeah.
But I wonder about how the settlers were responsible for why the government was making this all possible. They could wash their hands of the responsibility of that, but that would be in reverse in this case, of being the responsible party here. I think both were trying to shift the blame to other places.
Yeah. Good. What else did you note? Yeah, Sonia had her hand up.
Well, I find it so poignant and ironic that in this passage, the concern for manners and sort of this being good or being upright, like they're going to teach their children how to
may I
and not interrupt their parents, and this sort of the good life of these values. But it's in the face of this genocide that is happening and that they're living in the middle of, and I just think that that's a really poignant thing, that, you know, what are we not seeing about our stories or our lives, that we're worried about these things in front of us that seem right and good, but in the larger context.
Yeah. How can I just check in terms of hearing? When someone's speaking over this side of the room, can people over there hear?
Yeah.
You can hear.
100%.
Okay. I won't repeat then. If need be, if you don't hear something, just raise your hand and I'll repeat it over the mic so that you can hear it. Yeah, Libby.
I was struck when you said this was written in the 1830s or 40s.
Yeah.
And a kind of how early, not only the genocide, but how early our romance of it
is. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Cowboy Indian stories in 1850?
Yeah.
And then my mother going to campfire camp in the 20s, and it was all kind of pseudo-Indian names and beaver. And I mean, I remember that some of my childhood stories. So
yeah.
We've also developed this romance.
There's a note here that the author of the song's name is Marion Dick Sullivan, and she wrote the song, published it, the lyric, the you know, the sheet music in 1844. So, and it was, I don't know, like Boston or somewhere. So.
Well, we've been busy shutting down colleges already for 200 years.
Yeah.
I guess I shouldn't be surprised, but I
looked
up Tonto and what's his name.
Right.
So that's why that was sort of part of our generation. What was his name?
What's that? From Little House on the Prairie, the second one in the series, yeah. Any other comments before we go ahead? Yeah.
Well, such a sense that the Native Americans were not people.
Yeah.
The land belongs to those that get there first.
Yeah.
And not acknowledging that there's this beautiful population with a wonderful culture.
Yeah, there's a clear, in the way that Paul articulates that, there's a clear common sense perspective on his part that the Indians don't have any right to the land. The white people have a right to the land, and when the white people come, the Indians have to move, and the government does the dirty work of moving them. And it's just kind of straightforward in the way that he describes it.
The way it's supposed to be.
Yeah, back here.
I think there's even a phrase that is even clearer where she looks out onto the land and there are no people there.
Right.
It's only wild animals.
Yeah.
And when these were published, somebody responded to that, wrote in a letter to the publisher and said, "Do you know how this sounds?" And they said, "Well, we hadn't thought about that."
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, please.
Was a precedent kind of set, you know, when the Europeans were expanding and India and China, so is this something that the, you know, Americans were looking at?
Exactly. That's exactly
so
right.
Kind of, yeah. So that's, it's nothing.
That's what we're going to dig into next, is that history of how we as a nation borrowed justification from Europe and the Age of Discovery, quotes the Age of Discovery, for our taking of the Indian lands here in the United States. Yeah, Nelson.
They were basically considered subhuman, as were the blacks that they were bringing over for slaves.
Right.
I believe that the, going back as far as the Romans, that when they went up to Gaul and into Asia and brought back slaves,
yeah,
they were human. But certainly the blacks and the Indians were not.
That's it. So there's a very interesting, I'm not doing this history because I'm not looking particularly at the African American story in America, but there's a very interesting shift that happened in Virginia because of the need for all the labor for initially tobacco and then sugarcane. There was a very interesting legal shift from slaves being human to slaves being only two-thirds human, which allowed them to not have to release people from slavery after a period of time, but claim them as slaves and their children without the possibility, in other words, moving from a time-bound period of enslavement to your identity and the identity of your children being basically farm animals of a different sort. And you can see it's before the United States, but it was when Virginia was a colony, but you can read the legislative history where that shifted. It's like in the 1690s when they made that shift to describing African Americans as not fully human and therefore enslavable in perpetuity, and it doesn't work quite that way with the Native Americans. They're considered, like in the novels, wild like the wolves, like they're savages. They're not human in the same way because they're not civilized. It's not a percentage thing like they did with the African Americans. Well, let's look a little bit into this history, and I want to recommend Brian McLaren is a Christian pastor and author who writes a book a year. The guy is very prolific. This is his most recent book. It's called The Great Spiritual Migration: How the World's Largest Religion is Seeking a Better Way to Be Christian. And in this middle chapter, he's in a chapter called The Genocide Card in Your Back Pocket, kind of a provocative title. He says that most Christians, especially Christians of European descent, remain shockingly unaware of the violence in our history. And he says, quoting a Native scholar that I quoted from a couple days ago, Wise Yatowin, who's a Dakota scholar and writes about Dakota issues in the Midwest, among other things. He quotes her saying, he had to respond actually to this in a book of essays, saying, from her vantage point, Christianity has nothing, absolutely nothing, to teach indigenous people about how to live in a good way on the land. In fact, Christians have only demonstrated that there is something profoundly wrong with the cosmology and worldview behind more than five centuries of carnage, carnage that has even yet to slow down. And she goes on to say, I don't believe the religion is even salvageable. And so in this chapter, he asked the question, what would it mean to take her critique seriously about the history of violence in the Christian church, and to say that nonetheless there's something salvageable in the Christian tradition? And he says, if it's going to be salvageable, the only way is to admit all that is lost, all that we're blind to, all that's horrible, to admit, to look at that history and to admit it and to repent and to do actions of repair. So that's what he tries to dig into this in this chapter. And it's a really wonderful, horrifying simple summary of some of this history that I'm working on today. And so I the whole book is really good, but this chapter is a really helpful chapter. And I guess exemplify what he's talking about in terms of the way our histories often are told, the sort of white history of our country or a particular state, and what he's asking for. I'm just going to juxtapose a standard history of Minnesota and a more critical history of Minnesota, one written by a Euro-American author, one written by a Dakota author. And this is the quote from William E. Lass, Minnesota, A History. Like much of North America, Minnesota was first claimed by the French, who pushed westward into the heart of the continent by way of the Great Lakes. So this is how he's telling, narrating the story of the history of Minnesota. And let me just read the table of contents, just so you get a feel for his framing for the book. The first chapter, Minnesota and the Land. Second chapter, Europeans in the Wilderness. 3, America Asserts Herself. 4, Minnesota's Quest for Empire. 5, Trials of Statehood. 6, Peopling the Land. 7, 3 Frontiers. 8, A Legacy of Protest Politics. And 9, Minnesota and the Nation.
And that was published when?
Let's see. In 1977, in the State and the Nation series. So they have a book for every history of every state in this series. This is a quote from this author. Given Minnesota's largely unfettered celebration of statehood in 2008, it's clear there's a desperate need for reflection on the meaning of Minnesota statehood in the context of a genocidal and oppressive historical legacy. So in her book, she's calling for a reassessment of the way we tell our story. And the table of contents reads like this. Introduction, Envisioning Justice in Minnesota. Chapter 1, How Minnesotans Wrested the Land from the Dakota People. Chapter 2, A Call for Truth-Telling. Chapter 3, Taking Down the Fort, by which she means Fort Snelling, the original fort in Minnesota, but also taking down the symbolic myths that we use to hold up this story that we like to tell ourselves. And I would include the Little House on the Prairie stories as an example of that kind of iconic myth. Take down the fort. Chapter 4, just short of breaking camp. And chapter 5, developing peaceful coexistence. So she's actually interested in reconciliation. But she doesn't get there till the last chapter because there's a lot of things that have to happen before you can talk about reconciliation. So the whole rubric for this history often is described as the doctrine of discovery or the discovery doctrine. How many have heard that phrase? A good number of you. I want to transition to looking at a couple of pieces of that history by having a couple. There's a brief video of a couple of Native elders describing it. And I think it's really powerful to hear them describe learning about how white people justified taking away their land.
I was wondering why did they think it was right or just to do what they did was not to take our lands and to push us off our lands and to try to eliminate us as a people. And then we discovered this doctrine of discovery, and it just kind of made things understandable as to where they got their direction from.
When Columbus landed and he went back and he reported, and they said then, by the leaders, the Vatican was the most powerful voice in the world at that time. A papal bull, 1493, 1 year later. If there are no Christian nations in this new land you have discovered, I declare those lands to be empty. Terra nullius, very old Roman law that had been exercised in Africa, India, Europe. Further, if there are people there and they are not Christians, they do not have a right of title to land. They have only the right of occupancy. From our perspective, the same right as a rabbit running on the ground or a turkey or a deer or a buffalo, or it ended. I do not have a right of title to land. 1823, Supreme Court Justice John Marshall adjudicating the case, Johnson versus McIntosh. Two white men arguing over Ohio Indian land. He said, you boys have it all wrong. Don't you understand? This was settled long ago. They don't have a right of title to land. And he moved that principle into U.S. federal law, 1823. The doctrine of discovery became the doctrine of law today. Christian doctrine, specific. Wasn't Muslim doctrine. Wasn't Jewish doctrine. Christian. And it prevails. It's here. It's the reality. But most people don't understand that. Most people don't know that. We didn't even understand that on 1991, when I first really said, wow, what's the doctrine of discovery? What is that? A young man by a stage, name was Steve Newcomb, said, I got something, you guys gotta see it. Came out of Peru. Came out of people down there that were really digging. It was an unspoken conspiracy by states. Going on all those years. Don't tell the Indians. We found out anyway. Eventually, finally. 2007, Oneida versus New York, court case. First notation by a Supreme Court justice, doctrine of discovery. 2007. It's not alive. I think it's alive and well. 30-year court case for Onondaga Nation, dismissed, out of hand. Oh, you guys were too slow, it's too late. Let's make up, new latches, we'll call it. Besides, it's disruptive to our people. That's what the justice said. It's disruptive. No discussion about our people and about justice, about what's right. The American people don't know about this. Well, it's time they learn. It's time to learn because it's going to take all of us. It's going to take all of us, and I would be very, very, very careful about stamping out the last place that's holding the line the hardest. Within the Shawnee Six Nation, that's holding the line hardest for the common good, for the good of all, for the future. That's what I have to say.
What I'd like to do is just go through reading some of the excerpts from these, from moments in the history of the evolution of this doctrine, following from what they presented in this, and just let it be in the room without more commentary from me or from us, and then we'll talk together about it when I get to the end. First, the initial launching point of this at the beginning of Portugal's exploration in the 1440s and 1450s, first to the Canary Islands and then down to the west coast of Africa. The king of Portugal, Alfonso V, asked Pope Nicholas to issue a papal bull giving them support for their claims as they explored farther. I'll read a longer excerpt in which this quote is a part. It begins, "The Roman pontiff, successor of the key bearer of the heavenly kingdom and vicar of Jesus Christ, contemplating with the Father's mind all the several climes of the world and all and the characteristics of all the nations dwelling in them, and seeking and desiring the salvation of all, wholesomely ordains and disposes upon careful deliberation those things which he sees will be agreeable to the divine majesty, and by which he may bring the sheep entrusted to him by God into a single divine fold, and may acquire for them the reward of eternal felicity and obtain pardon for their souls. This, we believe, will more certainly come to pass through the aid of the Lord if we bestow suitable favors and special graces on those Catholic kings and princes who, like athletes and intrepid champions of the Christian faith, as we know by the evidence of facts, not only restrain the savage excesses of the Muslims and of other infidels, enemies of the Christian name, but also for the defense and increase of the faith, vanquish them and their kingdoms and habitations, though situated in the remotest parts unknown to us. And we thereby grant to freely invade, search out, capture, vanquish, and subdue all Muslims and pagans whatsoever and other enemies of Christ, wherever so placed, and the kingdoms, dukedoms, principalities, dominions, possessions, and all movable and immovable goods whatsoever held and possessed by them, and to reduce their persons to perpetual slavery, and to apply and appropriate to himself and his successors the kingdoms, dukedoms, counties, principalities, dominions, possessions, and goods, and to convert them to his and their use and profit." Forty-some years later, Pope Alexander VI issued another bull similar to this, defending Spain's explorations on the west coast of North and South America and granting similar rights to them wherever other Christian nations had not already made claims. So not allowing a claim on land that Portugal, for example, had claimed on the east coast of South America, but giving Spain similar rights. So those set the age of discovery, the age of exploration, on their way. I'm going to jump ahead to the Declaration of Independence. And one of the complaints that Thomas Jefferson lists in the Declaration of Independence is a complaint against King George because of his refusal to allow the colonies to use the doctrine of discovery to push the Indians out. And instead, they accuse the king of inciting the Indians to fight against the colonists. And this is the language of the Declaration of Independence. "He," that is the King of England, "has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions." So even in the founding documents of the U.S., this history is being debated. Then in 1823, the Supreme Court case that the video named Johnson versus McIntosh, Chief Justice John Marshall this isn't directly from the finding, but he wrote for a unanimous court, and he threw out the case, saying that their opinion conforms precisely to the principle which has been supposed to be recognized by all European governments from the first settlement of America. The absolute ultimate title has been considered as acquired by discovery, subject only to the Indian title of occupancy, which title the discoverers possessed the exclusive right of acquiring. And he used the analogy of a renter and the owner coming and saying the renter has to move. The renter is occupying the land but has no right of actual title or ownership to the land. And so the Indians can perpetually be moved from the land. And the justification for that is the trajectory going back to the papal bulls. That was 1823. Early 1830s, President Andrew Jackson called for the Indian Removal Act. This is actually from the records of Congress, May 28, 1830. And this was in order to move the Cherokee and other tribes out of the southern states in order to make room for farmers. And it set off what's famously known as the, infamously known as the Trail of Tears. Mm. And this is from Andrew Jackson's speech calling for this removal. Humanity has often wept over the fate of the aborigines of this country, and philanthropy has long been busily employed in devising means to avert it. But its progress has never for a moment been arrested, and one by one have many powerful tribes disappeared from the earth. But true philanthropy reconciles the mind to these vicissitudes as it does to the extinction of one generation to make room for another. Philanthropy could not wish to see this continent restored to the condition in which it was found by our forefathers. What good man would prefer a country covered with forests and ranged by a few thousand savages to our extensive republic, studded with cities, towns, and prosperous farms, embellished with all the improvements which art can devise or industry execute, occupied by more than 12 million? I think that's a misprint, but 12 million happy people and filled with all the blessings of liberty, civilization, and religion. That Indian Removal Act then set in motion a series of similar acts of Congress further on and subsequent treaties alongside those acts of removal, which all of us have some awareness of. So let me just pause there. And some of you know about this, some of you don't, but let me pause there and just see what kinds of reactions you have, what kinds of thoughts you have.
I'm thinking of the presiding bishop who wasn't even going to Standing Rock last fall, and she probably has a good sense of this history, of this, which, the details of which I'm not familiar with.
That reminds me that a number of Christian denominations very recently have officially repudiated the doctrine of discovery. And this, I just made a couple of copies of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America's repudiation of the doctrine of discovery, which was passed at the churchwide assembly in 2016. And official church statements always have a bunch of whereases. And one of them is to develop resources, to direct the domestic mission unit to develop resources to educate the members of the ELCA and the wider community about the doctrine of discovery and its consequences for Native peoples. So there are, I think, important steps being taken, a growing awareness of this, and steps being taken, and some important leadership from people like Bishop Eaton. Yeah, please.
I'm from North Dakota, actually. We're
And I thought something that was very interesting on a local level, not so much about all of the decisions there, was at our synod assemblies in Eastern and North Dakota. There's two synods there. Eastern North Dakota passed the Doctrine of Discovery within their resolutions.
Mm-hmm.
Western North Dakota did not.
Mm-hmm.
Do
you know any of the background of the yes and the no in those two synods?
A little bit of the background. It wasn't properly brought with enough time to the Western North Dakota Synod Assembly, and some of it was procedural.
Right.
But I was there at that full Synod Assemblies that year when it was going through, and I thought it interesting that why wouldn't they have been a little bit more urgent with their procedural pieces to put that before the people, and they couldn't procedurally put it before the people, even though they had a representative from Native Americans there to talk with the folks about it. And so it felt a little bit awkward that he or she was there to talk about this Doctrine of Discovery and the ongoing reconciliation that she hopes that the Native people and Lutheran Christians can continue to work toward. But we couldn't even bring that conversation to the assembly because it wasn't put forward in the right way.
Yeah. Thanks. And at the top of this, it lists all of the many synods who asked the national church to, in the Lutheran church, to do that. Other comments, reactions? Yeah, here.
I'm hoping to show the video Doctrine of Discovery that's made by Native American people that...
It's a longer documentary, right?
Yes,
yeah,
it's about an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And the reality is what's happening in the Middle East with... you know, all that we see with the beheading and all that is nothing compared to the way we got rid of the Native American people in our area. Just nothing.
Yeah, in the chapter I was referencing in Brian McLaren's book, he gives some excerpts that are just horrible. And the justification that they give is taken directly from the Pope, which is these are the devil's children and deserve to be destroyed, therefore. And in the worst ways, horrible ways. I mean, just as an example, they would tie up 13 Native peoples from their ankles, representing Christ and his 12 disciples, and light fires under them. As a kind of like, we're in the name of Christ and his apostles, we're destroying the children of the devil. Literally saying, you know, that's what they said they were doing in their journals. So that longer documentary goes into more of the consequences, not just the documentary history of the principle, but what happened as a result of it. There's someone else back here. Yeah, please.
Yeah, one thing I didn't know about the people poll was a strong language against the Muslims.
Yeah.
And considering what was happening in the mid to late 1400s,
right,
it kind of making sense what was happening in Europe and Africa and Middle East, and why the Pope, with the encouragement of the kings and such, would write such strong language.
That's right. I'm just learning a lot of this. I'm not at all an expert in this, but one feature that I learned as I was reading about this, in terms of the political history of Pope Nicholas V agreeing to do this for King Alfonso, was the Pope wanted to go retake Jerusalem from the Muslims. And he couldn't get King Alfonso to recruit troops for him to go on a crusade to Jerusalem to retake the Holy City. And when King Alfonso did agree to give the Pope troops to go on the crusade, then the Pope gave King Alfonso the papal bull that he wanted for his explorers who were going off. So it was absolutely a political tit for tat that led to that document being issued. It's fascinating.
Still going on?
Well, I don't know. Pope Francis is a pretty distinctive character, but I think he's no less political in his own way. his whole encounter with Trump was fascinating. That's a whole other story, but. Other comments, reactions, thoughts? Yeah, please.
So I have Cherokee in my background. Uh-huh. I've learned that the Cherokee people were considered civilized, and yet, and I mean, they were having people in Washington.
Right.
It's curious that this came about through all of that consideration.
Yeah.
Put them on that march.
4,000 died on the march, and another 4,000 died within a year after arriving. Just to. Yeah, right. Another example. I mean, that you're in a sense pointing out a level of hypocrisy about the naming of the native peoples as uncivilized. They were agricultural. You know, they were sophisticated in their land use. They were sophisticated in their political organization. I mean, our government system was literally modeled on the Iroquois Nation. Like, we took their way of governing themselves as a model for how we developed the U.S. political system. There was so much debate in the Continental Congress about how to organize our government. And this guy made the case that we should model it after the Iroquois Confederation. And that's just like, so, you know, you have to read Howard Zinn to hear that story, because it was totally suppressed that we could have learned, us, our civilized nation could have learned from the savages. So that's a whole piece of this. Like I talked, I mentioned in John, I think it was in your session, John, about the frames that we have that allow us to see or don't allow us to see what's in front of us based on the world that we have. And that's a piece of it. But then there's also this piece of just saying we can't acknowledge. Other comments? Yeah, Libby.
I wonder if anyone else in here had a short flicker of, boy, sure glad Martin Luther had a Reformation a few years later, and then remembering his anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
And so it was just
pretty
quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, please. I don't know.
Is there, when we talk about Christianity?
I don't know what they do. In terms of the relation, there's certainly intertwining of nationalism and politics and the Orthodox Church in lots of situations in Eastern history, but I don't know it well enough to know if there's. I mean, yeah. No. And it was, the split was 300 years before this, or 400 years before this, and so, in a sense, they were separate from, the Eastern Church was separate from this particular
right.
history, but I don't know if they did.
If there was something similar.
Yeah.
And if it's okay, then we group them as Christians differently.
Yeah. Yeah. Good question. We're just about at our time, so maybe a comment or two more. Yeah.
I was just going to say that I think that this relates to the situation today, whether we're talking about Standing Rock or, you know, within this state, there's still some that don't want to acknowledge the fishing treaties
right.
that were established, or don't think that it's fair.
One of the interesting consequences of the Johnson versus McIntosh case, the 1823 Supreme Court case, which he basically did, Justice John Marshall wrote an entire history of this doctrine of discovery in his what's it called, when you make a ruling and then the justice writes an opinion. In his opinion, he wrote a whole history of this doctrine. And one of the consequences of that was to say that, now I've lost my train of thought, where was I going with that? You were saying about treaties. Oh, well. I don't remember what I was going to say about the court case, but the treaties we're going to talk more about in the next session, and the way that they played into the Kansas situation in a Little House on the Prairie. It was called the Osage Minor Reserve, or what was it? Diminished Reserve, and the whole sort of treaty history of how that happened, and the fact that they even in Minnesota today are the Dakota and Ojibwe have cases in the court process just trying to have treaties from 1830 and from 1850 honored. I mean, it's just written there, but that we that whole history of not honoring the treaties. Oh, I know what I was going to say. In the Supreme Court case, the interesting thing they did was he said the only legitimate land agreement with Native peoples in legal terms is with the government. They can sell their land to the government, but they can't sell. They have no title to the land to sell it to another person. And that allowed, basically, it allowed the government to commandeer land without, in a sense, giving them, because it was in a sense saying the government can make an arrangement with this tribe. So there was a kind of accommodation of a certain kind of legal exchange that could happen between the government and a Indian nation. So, yeah.
Do you know anything about the legal precedent when we were talking about the occupying, not ability to own land, when reservations became an aspect of policy in the United States, whereby they become a sovereign nation and are able to, for all intents and purposes, own the land?
I'm going to talk about that next time, and I'll just give a sort of last comment, and then we're done for today. The Dawes Act, which was in the 1880s, is the point at which the government shifted to granting Native peoples individual rights to the land, because at that point it was convenient, because then they could say all the land that's not individually owned can be given to white settlers. So it was basically a trick to further reduce the reservation lands that had been granted to them, by giving them, instead of a tribe gets this whole reservation, each individual member of the tribe gets a piece of land, and all the rest of the reservation that's not then owned by a particular member of the tribe can be redesignated to white settlers. All right, thanks for coming. Enjoy the weekend.